Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 27th presentation of Inside the Beltway. And now I would like to turn things over to Friedrich. Please go ahead.
Kathy, thank you very much. And hello, everybody. This is Friedrich. I'm a partner with Drinker Biddle, and I'm the head of what we call the Arisa Financial Services Group, which represents mainly service providers to plans, people who sell products and services, investments to plans. With me is Brad Campbell, who, like me, is an ERISA attorney. And Brad is a former assistant secretary at the Department of Labor for retirement plans and health issues. Also with me are two of our securities lawyers, Jim Lundy and Sandy Granum. Jim, who was formerly with the SEC, is working on SEC issues for our clients, examinations and the problems that come up. Sandy, on the other hand, heads our FINRA practice group and works both in the FINRA compliance and the FINRA arbitration and controversy areas. And then finally, as you know, Jim Dolan is usually here. Jim can't be here today from NetTixis, but we have a more than capable replacement, who is James Eck. And James, I'll come to you in just a minute. I want to make one more announcement. We record these sessions, as Kathy said, and we will post them. It takes about 3 or 4 days to clean things up and get them posted. And if you remember, you can go to our website at www.drinkerbiddle.com and look under Insights and Events in about 3 or 4 days, or refer your friends and companions there. But even better than that, everybody who registered for the call, once it's posted, we will send you an email. And so you can have your fellow, offer it to your fellow workers or listen to it again yourself if you want. Now back to NetTixis. They sponsor these calls. They allow us to do things for you all that would be hard to do on our own, and we really appreciate their support. And so, James, I want to thank you very much, and if you have a word or two to say, feel free.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks a lot, Fred. Really appreciate that. So, of course, we really value the partnership that we've been able to establish with Drinker, Biddle, and Reith. So, again, as Fred mentioned, my name is James Eck. I'm an investment consultant on the DCIO team. If you're not familiar with NetTixis, we do have a multi-affiliate structure. We represent the likes of fund managers from Gateway and their option strategies to Loomis Sales, what they're doing in both fixed income and equities, and finally Harris Associates and the Oakmark funds. So just kind of wanted to briefly mention a product that was recently launched that we've seen start to really gain interest in the marketplace, and that's our ESG target date suite, the NetTixis Sustainable Future Funds. So with this fund offering, we've really taken advantage of the breadth of resources we have from the different fund managers. So the fund is completely run by our affiliates, and the performance has more than held up. And, of course, if you have any interest in hearing more about what we're doing with our target date series, we'd be more than happy to get that information out to you folks. So, again, thank you all for joining the call, and we look forward to any questions you may have at the end. But for now, I'll turn it back over to Fred. Thank you so much.
Hey, James. Thank you very much. And we're going to go off agenda for a moment here, everybody. There is late-breaking news, and we want to bring you up to date on it. Some of you have probably already heard that Nevada has a statute that would impose fiduciary status, let me just overly generally say, on broker-dealers as well as RIAs. Well, that statute couldn't be implemented until there were regulations. Just within the last week or so, those proposed regulations were issued, and they have really surprised the regulated community, if you will, the broker-dealers and RIAs and so on, but particularly the broker-dealers, because of a number of provisions in the proposed regulations. So, Brad, I know, you know, you're representing some clients and working with the state of Nevada on that. Or at least in helping them shepherd their views along the way. Why don't you fill us in on what you think some of the key points are and what we should be thinking about?
Sure, and just to clarify that comment, I am not working with the state of Nevada or anyone working with the state of Nevada. We're representing other clients who would be impacted by the Nevada regulation. But that aside, yeah, last Friday, the state of Nevada put out the proposed regulations implementing their fiduciary duty law for securities transactions, and the comment period on this will end on March 1st. And I think it's fair to say that it is a much more expansive and broad rule than I think most observers were expecting. As Fred said, and he wasn't oversimplifying by much, I think, it really does establish a fiduciary standard pretty much for most broker-dealer interactions as well as RIAs. Among some of the provisions that are in it, for example, if you are duly registered as a broker-dealer or RIA, you cannot take advantage of any of the exemptions, so to speak, that it provides for broker-dealers. You're treated as an RIA for the purposes of the rule if you're duly registered. In terms of some of the potential exemptions, they're pretty narrow. So, for example, you would be a fiduciary, whether you're a broker-dealer or RIA, if you provided investment advice, and the definition of investment advice is extremely broad. It doesn't just include making recommendations, but one of the things that you could do that is investment advice is providing analysis or reports regarding a security to a client. Note that that's not a recommendation. That is an analysis or report prepared presumably by some third party or yourself, which would then by itself be considered investment advice. But let's say you were a broker-dealer providing investment advice. You could have a duty as a fiduciary only with respect to that one bit of advice, the episodic fiduciary duty exemption in the proposed rule. And all that really gets you, it means you are a fiduciary as for that recommendation, but it wouldn't trigger an ongoing duty to monitor in that relationship. But to qualify for that, there are a host of restrictions to get that episodic, including that the client has to solicit the investment advice. So if you go on through what's here, I think a couple other things that are interesting to point out. It prohibits the use of certain terms in describing yourself. So if you were trying to use the episodic fiduciary duty exemption, for example, you could not call yourself an advisor, whether with an O or an E, a financial planner, a financial consultant, a retirement planner, a wealth manager, a counselor, or other titles that the administrator may deem by order to be part of that. This does allow you to make a recommendation of a proprietary product. It does seem to allow for commissions and markups and markdowns on commissions. There are, it doesn't appear to inherently change the compensation arrangements, although it does have an extensive disclosure section. But one of the things that raises a little question about that is while it doesn't seem to prohibit those types of compensation, it also says that there's language in here essentially to the extent that this compensation doesn't run afoul of the other requirements. So there's a potential conflict here between what's permitted and what isn't in compensation under the fiduciary standard. So that's based on a quick read of it. There's going to be a lot more detail as we parse through it. The one last observation, and then Fred, I'll turn it back to you for some comments on it because I know you've looked at it as well. One observation I'll make is that even though Nevada passed this law in 2017, and we spent all of 2018 waiting for this proposed regulation to come out, I have to say I am not impressed with the quality of the drafting that's in this proposal, and I think it's kind of interesting. Let me just say this. It doesn't look like the product of, say, 14 months of deep thought about how to proceed. It has some concerns, and I think the comments will probably raise some of those internal inconsistencies and problems with the way it's drafted as we go forward. Fred?
Yeah, a couple additional comments. I mean, picking up on what Brad said about the duty to monitor, as you might imagine, it starts off with this concept of episodic recommendations or advice, in which case there is no duty to monitor. But then it goes on to say, however, you do have a duty if the following things occur. And one of them is if you provide ongoing financial planning. That then turns you from a episodic or transaction-based advisor into having a duty to monitor. Another one is, and it's not worded exactly this way, but I think it will be interpreted this way, is that if you say to your customer, I'll oversee your account, and if anything bad happens or if there's any changes are needed, I'll get back to you. That statement would create a duty to monitor, notwithstanding the fact that the policies and procedures of the broker-dealer may be that they don't monitor. So that monitoring area, I think, is a pretty touchy thing, particularly since most broker-dealers aren't set up to supervise monitoring and to make sure that it's actually happening. However, if you said to me, what is the single biggest difference between regulation best interest, the SEC's proposed regulation, and this rule, what do I think will have the greatest impact? It wouldn't be the duty to monitor, although I do think that's a biggie. I think the biggest single difference is there is a private right of action under this Nevada law and regulation. In other words, investors can sue for losses, where under regulation best interest, if the broker-dealer or its financial advisor violates the best interest standard of care, assuming the rule becomes final as written, there is no private right. Only the SEC and FINRA could enforce that. And they have limited resources, so they can only go so far. So in my mind, that single thing will make the Nevada rule in its limited geographic area much more impactful than Reg BI. But that's what leapt off the page to me, although I agree with Brad. I think we're we've done our preliminary analysis, but we really need to go back and look at it more thoughtfully and get some comments filed on behalf of our clients. So Brad, shall I move on, or did you want to jump back in with one more thing?
Well, one last thing I would just say about this. This is, in some ways, the opening salvo of what's going to be a much broader war, which is various states jumping forward with their own fiduciary or best interest standards applicable to securities transactions or insurance transactions. And it's not, strictly speaking, the first salvo. Obviously, the state of New York has put in place a new best interest regulation for annuity and life insurance transactions. But, you know, we have New Jersey. The state of New Jersey is going to issue a proposed regulation establishing a fiduciary standard shortly. We have a number of other states thinking about it. This as a public policy matter, I personally am concerned about the notion of kind of the balkanization of fiduciary and best interest standards across all these states. And it's something that we at the firm are working with clients on and really tracking quite closely. Because whether you call it fiduciary, whether you call it best interest, we're seeing a confluence of regulatory interests across a lot of different regulatory stovepipes. And I think we're going to spend a lot of time working with our clients to figure out how to comply with slightly different yet simultaneously applicable standards going forward. And so that's something as a firm we're spending a lot of time internally getting ourselves ready to help clients with.
Yeah. I agree. I think we're at the beginning of the curve on this one. Brad, let's move on to the next topic. And as you know, there are a lot of legislative proposals about retirement plans in the second half of last year. In effect, they all died when that Congress adjourned, and then they have to be reintroduced in the new Congress. But what do you think, if you had to pick out a handful of the important things that not only will be introduced, but that have a good chance of passage and that will affect the retirement world, what do you see? What's your crystal ball say to you?
Yeah, obviously, when we were sending out the invitations for this, what we had hoped would happen is the end of the last Congress would result in some kind of big omnibus bill providing some funding, and into it would be the vehicle moving to which they would attach some new retirement plan reforms that would generally be very bipartisan and well-supported and make a lot of good changes. Unfortunately, as you all know, that hasn't happened, and so we're in a very different place. That said, though, I think there is some reason to be optimistic about the future of retirement reform, so to speak, here in this Congress. We have a lot of very serious bipartisan efforts that are going on. While the Senate RESA bill of the last Congress, and there was Portman Cardin legislation introduced, we're going to see again legislation from Senator Portman and Senator Cardin that have a lot of very significant provisions in them if it looks like the bill they introduced at the end of last year. with automatic enrollment increases to 6% with an escalation to 10% over 5 years, student loan matching, an extension of defined contribution eligibility to part-time workers. There's a whole host of reforms in that legislation. The Senate RESA bill, we think, will be reintroduced as well in some forms, and there are a lot of useful reforms there. One thing that we should certainly mention are whether they called it pooled employer plans or open MEPs, open multiple employer plans. The concept being, let's take a bunch of unrelated, otherwise unrelated businesses together and let them act as one plan with economies of scale that come from being essentially one plan despite multiple participating employers. And have 1,500 and one, plan audit. And the legislation out there would facilitate that. The various versions would address the so-called one bad apple rule, which says that, if one of these employers runs afoul of tax qualification issues, it won't taint the entire pool. All of those types of issues, there's a lot of support for those to move forward. And if there is a retirement bill, I think coming out of this Congress, there probably will be a lot of agreement on those provisions. One of the things that's interesting, and I'll be brief about this, but looking at Chairman Neal, the now chairman of the Ways and Means Committee from Massachusetts, he's had a couple of very interesting ideas in the past, and we expect to be pursued this year. And the one that I think is probably the most significant is the notion that retirement plans would essentially be required for private sector employers above a certain size. And I think in his legislation last year, he said if you had more than 10 employees and you had been in business longer than 3 years, you would have to sponsor a 401k or a 403b plan. But there would be a lot of limitations on some of the difficulties. There would be limited fiduciary responsibility. It would also have MEPs in it, some other ways to mitigate the effects to some extent of that mandate, small business credits available to offset the costs. So there's a lot of interest in moving forward with those. The question is, will there be a vehicle moving? When we have a divided government with the Republican House, the Republican Senate, the Democrat House, and President Trump, will there be a vehicle that can get enough agreement to actually pass at all? And, that's the bigger question. Can we get to an agreement on retirement policy and positive changes? Yes, I do believe a bipartisan agreement on that can happen this year. Will that find a way to get passed into law? That's probably the bigger question. So I think there are reasons to be optimistic, Fred, about some of the retirement legislation, even though we didn't get what we hoped for, which was sort of a Christmas present of some reforms last December.
Yeah. And, Brad, I mean, the area that particularly interests me is retirement income. And let me put a little background on that. It seems to me that there are really two parts of saving and investing and withdrawing for retirement. And, the first part that we focus 95% or 98% of our attention on has been accumulation. How much am I deferring? Am I in the plan? How am I investing in the plan? And so on. And in talking with one of the top experts in the country on retirement plans from a more practical, not a legal perspective, he said he thinks that's solved. And what he meant by that was that all the tools are there, automatic enrollment, automatic deferral increases, default investing, that if a plan sponsor seriously wants to get its participants in the right place, all the tools are there. It can be done. Not that we can't improve, not that we can't create more services and investments, but by and large, the building blocks are in place. It's just up to plan sponsors to use them and of course, up to participants to take advantage of them. But the second part, the second half of that, that in my mind is really undeveloped, is the from the moment of retirement, from the moment of beginning to need that money to live on, the 401k account to live on, until death, 15, 20, 25, 30 years later. My mom recently passed away at 101. I mean, that's, 36 years after age 65? People live that long, and we don't know which ones, but in any event, there's this whole uncharted area of how does a 401k account last for 20, 30, 40 years. And Congress has a real concern about that. From a public policy perspective, it does not make sense for 90-year-old Americans to be living just on Social Security and welfare. There's got to be a better way. And so there are three provisions included in some of these bills that I'm getting to. Number one is a projection of retirement income, mandating that 401k plan sponsors, through their providers, project retirement income for participants and give it to them at least once a year. I assume that the retirement industry will then do gap analysis as an add-on, and that the participant will be told, you know, based on general standards or rules of thumb, you're on course or you're not. If you're not, you should be deferring another $25 a pay period. I'm making these numbers up, but you get the idea. That would help people, and then it says how much they'll get a month in retirement. That would help people understand that the purpose of the 401k plan is not to accumulate wealth, but instead to provide income. So that's a biggie in my mind. Number two, they would facilitate, matter of fact, make it ridiculously easy to prudently select insurers to provide annuities or guarantees within the plan. And I'm working on projects, several projects on that right now. I believe it's a coming thing in a big way. But essentially, the bills that I've seen take a checklist approach. If you get this, 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 and this, and this, that's enough. You don't even have to evaluate it. You just have to get it. But obviously, there are a handful of things, like is the insurance company in good standing and so on and so forth. So that checklist approach to allowing plan fiduciaries, plan committees to select insurers without fear of liability if the insurer goes under in the future. And then number three is a provision that would permit distributions from plans if participants have accumulated guaranteed retirement income, and then the plan sponsor decides to switch to another provider that won't support that. So rather than the participants losing their accumulated benefits under that proposal, they could actually take a distribution and roll it to an IRA. So the area that I'm paying the most attention to is lifetime income, everything that has to do with lifetime income, and how Congress is going to facilitate the process for doing that. So, Brad, I'll bounce it back to you if you want to add anything.
Yeah, I would say those issues are within many of the various legislative proposals that people are talking about. One I would add to that is the version of the Senator Portman and Cardin legislation from December included encouraging QLACs, longevity annuities, to control some of that tail end risk of people outliving their retirements as well. And I think those are important issues. They're not easy ones to solve. And I think even if we do get congressional approval of some of those, we're still going to see a lengthy process at, for example, the Labor Department on some of these regulations. This issue of projecting retirement benefits, what would be the retirement income generated by your current account balance if we were to project it forward, is a simple concept with a host of technical issues. And how they do that safe harbor, is it a one-size-fits-all definition of how you calculate it in order to have reduced liability for making such a projection? Is it a looser safe harbor that allows many different ways to calculate that projection, in which case maybe there's less security for making it and concerns about what if people rely on this projection and then come back and say I misled them? DOL went down the road of trying to do a proposed regulation and doing a request for information in the Obama administration on this projection issue. And ultimately, I think the agency abandoned the project. Obviously, they wouldn't be able to abandon the project if Congress moves forward. But I think you're right, Fred, that the kind of next logical phase in public policy is the spend down phase, because I agree with you, we've done a good job on the accumulation phase. But I think we're also going to continue to see fights over access, again, going back to the state issue, as more states adopt these payroll deduction IRAs and secure choice proposals. We're going to see more debate about whether the current system, whether it has the right building blocks or not, reaches enough people. And that's, I think, where we're going to see that access debate play itself out in the Congress.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Brad, let's move on to the next topic, and it's DOL investigations. And let me start off by talking about the missing participant investigations by the DOL. This has caught people off guard. Several of the plan sponsor organizations have complained to the Department of Labor and asked for better guidance. But what's happened is all across the country, DOL investigators, when they investigate a plan sponsor, they're saying, what are you doing about missing participants? And in this case, the definition of a missing participant is somebody who has an account balance in the plan but is no longer working there. And they left their account behind. and the DOL investigators in some cases are taking very aggressive positions. For example, you breached your fiduciary duty by not searching for missing participants every year and by not using different search methods each time. That, to me, is far more than the law requires. But as you might imagine, when the plan sponsor hears that, they're shocked because they didn't even know they were supposed to be searching at all, much less every year and using all different kinds of search methods. But there is some guidance out there, and I think it's important for any plan sponsors on the line to pay attention to this, for any advisors on the line or TPAs, record keepers, to educate plan sponsors that they need to be paying attention to this and to outline the steps. There are a host of internal steps that can be taken, like email addresses, beneficiaries named for their account balance, death benefits, beneficiaries under the group term life insurance. I mean, there are a whole host of ways internally that a company could try to find people. Then there are free ways externally, internet searches, Facebook, you name it. And then there are external ways that you have to pay for, like a commercial locator service. In any event, all of that, the record keepers and third-party administrators can help you understand what they do and why they do it and how they do it. And I think it's important to get that for plan sponsors to have that information and to make sure that it's being done every year. Let me make one more point, and I'm going to turn over to see what Brad thinks about it. And then, Brad, when you're done telling us your thoughts, why don't you segue into the National Project on Plan Investment Consultants or Plan Investment Conflicts. Here's my thought. Here's what a plan sponsor should do in addition to working with their service providers to find out what the detailed steps are. One, I think they should have a written internal process. What is your process for doing this? Whatever the decisions are that are made after looking at that information, document that in writing so that it is done on a regular basis, so that if somebody moves from that position to another position, the new person at the company has that in writing so they know what to do. Number two, as that suggested, designate a specific employee or a specific provision who is responsible for maintaining the records and making these efforts to locate missing participants. And number three, engage in a regular practice of contacting former participants or doing searches. If you can't find them, doing searches and letting them know about their benefits and letting them know that they can take distributions. So if you get that part, if you do that, plus you take reasonable internal steps, reasonable external free steps, and a reasonable external step that costs money, you're going to be in pretty darn good shape. So, Brad?
Yeah, I would just say this is one of those enforcement policies that's kind of jumped up fairly quickly. It was born out of DOL looking at defined benefit plans on the IRS also, and now it's morphed over into defined contribution plans. But it has literally come up within the last year in every single plan sponsor investigation we've been a part of, even ones that had been going on for 2 years on completely unrelated topics that we were trying to close out at the end of last year. The investigator would say, hey, I just got this list of questions from the national office I have to ask you about before we can close this out. And then we went through the whole missing participant process and what you do. Bottom line especially is if you can't account for your folks who are supposed to be receiving required minimum distributions, that's going to be a real problem with the department. So all the steps Fred laid out, while we don't have the definitive guidance we would like, and we and many others have been asking the department for more clarity, and while there are limited options in terms of other programs, for example, there's a missing participant program at the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, but it's only available for terminated plans, doing the best you can to make sure addressing this issue is going to save you a lot of heartburn if DOL does come knocking. Just a quick comment. Yeah, go ahead.
Brad, let me just add one thing. So that you know, if you have a robust internal, if a plan sponsor has a robust internal process for finding missing participants, the DOL, or the IRS rather, has a temporary non-enforcement policy. It's not called a non-enforcement policy, but if you read it, that's what it is. So, but you better be able to show you got the right process in place. The non-enforcement policy only applies to the minimum required distributions that Brad said. So once an employee gets to be 70 and a half, if you have to make distributions if they're no longer working for you, but if you can't find them, how are you going to do it? Well, you have to have a robust internal process that the IRS says is satisfactory, or they will come after you on plan qualification issues. So Brad brought up a great point there. And for the moment, the answer is have a really great process internally. So back to you, Brad.
Yeah, so Fred, you asked briefly about the program that's going on with plan investments. I look at it this way. In the past, DOL has been targeting the service provider side of this equation, looking at the fiduciary service provider project. That's now sort of morphed into this plan-based project. And essentially, rather than looking at specific service providers and how they're getting paid and what their standard contracts are and how they're engaging with plans on investment issues, DOL is now putting that in as part of the review they're conducting of plans. So they're looking at the nature of the agreement with the plan, with its advisors and its investment managers, the compensation arrangements, the disclosures, and that's part of what they're looking at in the context of that. So I think it's an ongoing issue. A couple of things that we've seen flagged in recent investigations, one that's coming up a lot both in litigation as well as DOL investigations, is why did you pick the share classes you picked? Should you have picked that one? Was it the appropriate one? Occasionally you'll have investigators use terms they shouldn't, like was it the cheapest one, which of course we all know it's about picking a prudent one, not necessarily the cheapest one. And there's been a few cases where we've had to go back and forth with investigators to make sure they understood why in fact, say in a case, the more expensive quote-unquote share class was in fact on net, was in fact on net prudent, given that it created revenue sharing that might be used to offset other expenses, et cetera. So goes back to the adage that, it's not an adage, but the advice that we'll often hear from ERISA attorneys, which is on your investment process, you have a lot of latitude in how you set up the arrangements, but you need to know, understand, and have evaluated why you made the decisions you did, know what revenue is going where, what it's being used for, and why. Brad?
Yeah, Brad, the one area that I'm most concerned about on the 408B2 disclosures, I think most people got it right. Back in 2012 and when they picked up new clients since then. What I'm really worried about is whether broker-dealers are updating their 408B2 disclosures under the 408B2 change requirement. That if you flip out one fund for another fund, are you updating your 408B2 disclosures on the compensation you're receiving from the new fund? I'll tell you the reason I'm concerned about it. No client over the last 7 years has asked me to review a change disclosure. I'm wondering if they're just not happening. If it's a fee for an RIA, they're going to have an amendment to the agreement, I assume, so that it would be documented, or a letter, or a memo, or an email. But I wonder about indirect compensation as opposed to direct compensation. Anyway, we'll see as these investigations develop. Time to shift gears on everybody on the line. We're going to go from having a couple of ERISA attorneys talk to you to have some securities lawyers talk to you. We're going to start off with Jim Lundy. Jim has handled a number of the applications to the Securities and Exchange Commission under the Share Class Selection Disclosure Initiative. That's where ADVs for RIA firms said, for example, we may recommend investments that pay 12b1 fees and on top of our advisory fee. And the SEC has come on and said, may doesn't work. If you're going to do that, you have to say, we do. So, Jim, could you give us sort of a post-mortem on what's happened since that program was closed down and where we go from here?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I wish I could say that it's closed down. Unfortunately, for lack of a better term, the closing down of the SEC due to the government shutdown and the furloughs caused a delay.
Jim, I'm sorry. I misspoke. I meant since the end of the since the deadline for filing with the SEC under the initiative. Yeah,
well,
I misspoke.
Really understandable. Yeah, no problem at all. And I was actually trying to make a play on the terms there, because the closing down of the SEC has been the most significant development. So with that perspective in mind, we had moved fairly along through the process. Despite it being a self-reporting and cooperative effort, The staff was at times appropriately aggressive to push back on arguments that we raised on behalf of clients. That said, I think we were successful in carving out by a categorization strategy certain revenue streams and being able to support that those revenue streams, while they did involve 12b-1 fees, due to, for example, offsets or other things that were done from a business perspective, should not be included in a disgorgement amount. So we were able, for the clients we've been working with, to reduce a gross disgorgement number to a net number and have the net number be a number that resulted in the majority of the gross number being deductible. So we were pleased with that, and ultimately were able to reach agreement with the enforcement staff for several clients. And at that point in time, as occurs when working across from the government, the papers were circulated, and we reviewed those. And there was an initial deadline, and I think this is probably what you and I discussed, Fred, of January 7th. In the interim, obviously, the shutdown and furloughs impacted the ability to finalize things before then. That date was extended to January 22nd, and has since been extended to February 1st. The delays have been somewhat helpful because it's allowed us to spend more time on the orders. There was some new information in the draft orders, two principal pieces that we need to still work through once the staff gets back to work and the furloughs come to an end. The first is, while there were specific undertakings discussed in the announcement and throughout the initiative as when it was discussed publicly, there was a broader commitment being required in the settlement papers for a self-administered distribution fund that is going to require additional time and resources for the clients. Some clients have actually expressed an interest in using a third party, and will need to be negotiating with the staff regarding this particular issue. The other issue that, while not surprising, was disappointing, involves what's called the once-over footnote. Some people who do enforcement work or are familiar with SEC enforcement matters may be familiar with it. If you're not, it's a footnote that cites back to a 2000 D.C. Circuit case that says, despite certain violations being non-scienter-based, that this particular circuit court at the appellate level interpreted them to be willful. The reason why that's important is if that footnote remains included, that willful language can be a trigger to require joint registrants with duly registered broker-dealers who are FINRA members to go through the eligibility proceeding process. While not a guarantee, particularly for this type of situation, FINRA does typically, after consideration, grant those for non-scienter-based SEC settlements. However, once again, it's an additional resource commitment and an additional hurdle that these clients need to go through that I think when the initiative was first rolled out was really not adequately described. I will say that we're advocating for the once-over footnote to be removed. SIFMA has submitted a letter on behalf of the industry raising a variety of arguments, including a removal of this footnote. So if we are successful in that regard, that may do away with that and make the need for the FINRA eligibility proceedings unnecessary, hopefully. One other development, Fred, that I think has occurred more recently, and you and I have talked about this, is the priority for the SEC and in particular enforcement for 2019 appears to have shifted from 12b-1 fees and 12b-1 fee disclosures to revenue sharing. I had a couple of clients who elected for a variety of reasons to not go through the initiative. As promised by the SEC, they have now received document requests from the Enforcement Division to provide documents regarding their 12b-1 fee practices and disclosures. However, these matters are not limited to 12b-1 fees. They include requests for information regarding their revenue sharing arrangements and their disclosure practices regarding those arrangements. I also have a client who received a standalone document request from the Enforcement Division regarding revenue sharing arrangements and the related disclosures. And I have another client going through an examination where that issue is raised by the examination staff and a significant finding. So historically, the 12b-1 fee initiative, we are getting closer to the finish line. If the furloughs and shutdown come to an end, I would expect those to be publicly issued sometime in the March timeframe. But again, we're kind of subject to whatever occurs with the federal government shutdown and the furloughs of the vast majority of the staff. Going forward, I think revenue sharing is going to be a point of emphasis for 2019, And for firms that may have those issues who have not heard from the SEC, they should take advantage of that and do an assessment of what those agreements say and make sure that those agreements align with the disclosures, because if there is a disconnect and you hear from the examination or even worse, the enforcement staff, you know, there's a chance you have exposure to an SEC action.
Yeah, Jim, I on the two cases that are for my clients that or that we've talked about, where they've come in after the application period closed, it is the enforcement staff that is conducting the investigation, right?
It is, and like a lot of practitioners, I had assumed that the enforcement staff would leverage the examination staff and their capability pursuant to registrant's obligation to make books and records available to have the examination staff, through some sort of a quote-unquote sweep effort, do the follow-up. And as you said, Fred, for your clients who I'm working with, that's not the case. It's a much more aggressive posture, and the request came directly from the enforcement division, unfortunately. You know, that said, we do feel for both of those clients that there are strategies. One in particular has very strong disclosures. The other one did do, you know, some very diligent work to assess the initiative and whether it applied to their practices. So just because it came from enforcement does not mean that we're not going to be successful at the end of the day to persuade the enforcement division to issue termination letters and close their matters. But you raise a very good point that what has occurred is a much more aggressive posture at the start, in that you're dealing with enforcement regarding these follow-ups.
Yeah, I would think any representatives of RIA firms on the line, you need to go back and look at your ADV disclosures and have somebody who's familiar with the Share Class Selection Disclosure Initiative and who's familiar with these new enforcement actions or enforcement investigations, look at it. Because my view of what the SEC has done is they've taken a common practice that's been common over the last 10, 20, 30 years, and they're now saying it doesn't work. A common disclosure does not work. And if you're making it the old way, you're in trouble. And talking with Jim, I think the SEC is also saying, in so many words, hey, we gave you a chance to come in under a self-disclosure initiative. You didn't do that. Now we're going to hit you with a baseball bat if we find you did it wrong. So be very careful about this, folks. It's a big deal.
Yeah, hey, Paul, I couldn't have said it any better. And what we have started to do is work, as you know, with our colleagues in our investment management group who have some technical expertise on ADV disclosures. And we've gotten those calls from clients to work with them proactively to enhance and get more specific with their disclosures. And in doing so, we're trying to get out in front of any contact they may have from the SEC. And I'd recommend folks consider that as a strategy that they can use to fend off the SEC, you know, if such a notification or request is on the horizon for their firm.
Great. Well, thanks, Jim. Jim, I think we ought to move on to Sandy. And Sandy, you know, I think sort of in our discussions within the firm, there's sort of the big three. One is, fiduciary or best interest standard of care and conflicts. Another is cybersecurity. And then number three is older or senior investors. Why don't you bring us up to speed with where we are in number three from your perspective, elder abuse,
sure.
Older investors, and all that.
So FINRA continues to focus on elder abuse this year. On January 22nd, it issued its 2019 Annual Risk Monitoring and Examination Priorities Letter. And among the things that were highlighted in that letter was the fact that, and I'll paraphrase here, but that FINRA was focusing on the protection of senior investors as well as investors who are retired or approaching retirement, and that would remain at the top of FINRA's view scope. The focus will be on firms protecting persons from fraud, sales practice abuse, and financial exploitation. And just as a sort of a reference of what's going on, I took a look at some of the regulatory proceedings that happened in the latter part of last year, and those were specific to brokers, but really sort of shows you what FINRA is looking at. So, for instance, an October AWC, which is a settlement, indicated that the broker had recommended unsuitable recommendations to an elderly, widowed, unemployed customer living on fixed income by suggesting that she continue to invest in energy sector, notwithstanding her profile. Another one that might be a little bit more interesting to this group was a broker in October who was suspended for 9 months and fined $10,000 because he recommended annuity transactions to retired elderly customers, failing to facilitate the transaction as a tax-free 1035 exchange. In August 2018, a broker was found to have engaged in unsuitable trading for an elderly customer because he recommended mutual fund Class A shares in 20 different mutual fund families rather than consolidating it into lesser families. And as a result, FINRA determined that the elderly woman paid excessive sales charges that did not have to be paid and ended up paying commissions of $60,000 when it could have been reduced by $30,000. FINRA went on to say that it's going to assess the firm's supervision of accounts where registered representatives serve as fiduciaries, including holding power of attorneys, acting as trustees or co-trustees, and having some kind of beneficial relationship with non-familial customer accounts. And there were actually enforcement proceedings that sounded very much like that as well. In August 2008, a broker entered filed a complaint. FINRA filed a complaint against a broker who held a position of trustee, beneficiary, and broker for an account and ended up taking $400,000 out of the elder person's account prior to the estate going to probate. FINRA has also indicated that, well, one of the other things that I should point out is in 2017, there were 61 cases that alleged elder abuse filed in the FINRA arbitration. In 2018, there were 2,016 cases that alleged elder abuse filed in FINRA arbitration. Now, before 2017, FINRA actually did not look for that allegation and claim, so there's no record, and it's true 2 years can't give us true statistical data, but there does seem to be a significant increase between 61 versus 216. And whether that's because there's been a surge of more elder abuse or whether it's because claimants' counsel now believe that FINRA is focused on that topic, and so they're raising the issue more than they did, say, in 2017. It's unclear from these stats, because what we have is the bare numbers, but it's indicative of the fact that people are focusing on this as a significant issue. It used to be the case, and I'll refer you to an article that was in the material that was circulated, that was written by my colleagues and myself, called Vulnerable Investor Protection Tales from the Broker Side. So it used to be the case that when the regulators and the SROs were looking at elder abuse, they were looking at it really as brokers taking advantage of their older clients. Starting this year, there's been some recognition that the broker can be on the forefront of situations where other third parties are taking advantage of elder or senior investors, and the broker can see it happening because they see money moving in and out of the account. And prior to new regulations, which were issued in the fall of 2018, FINRA issued rules that that gave brokers permission to freeze accounts or stop it temporarily from moving out, FINRA Rule 2165, and asked broker-dealers to go out and get names of individuals that were trusted individuals for their clients, Rule Number 4512, prior to those rules coming into place, which would have acknowledged that the broker was in this place of standing, protecting the elderly from abuse from third parties. it was very difficult for a broker to stop something from happening because there was bank privacy rules that prevented them from reaching out to third parties, and there were instruction rules that prevented them from not abiding by what the elder client might have instructed them to do. So generally the way things were done is if there was an issue, the funds would be interpleaded to the court, and the court would make a determination who was really to get the disputed funds. This gives the brokerage firm an added ability to step in between what it believes to be an abusive situation and their clients. In keeping with that, there was recently enacted and passed in May of 2018 the Senior Safe Act, and that was likewise an act which provided immunity to certain defined financial advisors and financial institutions to disclose potential examples of financial exploitation of senior citizens. So there's been kind of a bracketing in the brokerage firm industry, both on the side of protecting seniors from abusive financial advisors, but also giving the financial advisors some instruments to protect their clients from abusive family members, sort of now recognizing that they too can be methods of preventing abuse. And I would refer you to the article, which sort of gives a little bit of background of how this came to be and basically why it's become the new focus with the aging population in the U.S. FINRA did review certain research, the MetLife study of elder financial abuse, crimes of vacation, desperation, and predication against American elders, and FINRA's Investment Education Foundation Financial Fraud and Fraud Susceptibility, and determined that of all the elder abuse, the most popular elder or the most common elder abuse is financial exploitation. So I'll turn it back over to you, Fred.
Well, thank you. We're going to go to questions now, but we've got a bunch of pre-submitted questions. Fortunately, most of them were already answered during the presentation. So I'm going to ask just one or two of them to the panelists here, and then we'll move on to questions over the phone line. But several of them about what's the status of different IRS guidance and SEC guidance. Of the four agencies that we've talked about today, or the four entities that we've talked about, the SEC and the IRS are on shutdown. Now, they have a limited number of people working, but not the people that write regulations. So the answer is, for any IRS or SEC guidance, they're on shutdown. And we don't know when they're coming back, and it'll probably take them a little while to get geared up again, and then they will have to go back to work. So everything is delayed is the answer. Also, on cognitive impairment, elder abuse, whatever you want to call it, one of our people who registered for this program sent me a link to a Society of Actuaries research report. So it's SOA, Society of Actuaries, Cognitive Impairment or Cognitive Compensation or Conversation Research Report, 2018. If you want to Google that, that is an excellent piece of work. It's not government work, and it may or may not influence the government, but it's if you have older people in your family, or if you want to see read an article about what the signs are of deteriorating cognitive ability, read that. It's really impartial and really well done. Just a couple of quick questions. Brad, somebody emailed a question. Can record keepers aggressively try to capture rollovers from plan participants? I'll give you my quick knee-jerk reaction. Since the Fifth Circuit threw out the new fiduciary rule, the old fiduciary rule came back into effect, and it requires advice. Be on an ongoing basis to be fiduciary advice. The critical question there is the record keeper providing advice to the participant, or is the record keeper providing advice on behalf of the plan? At first you might think to the participant, but if I were a plaintiff's attorney, I'd say, who pays the record keeper? The plan. Therefore, arguably, the advice is on behalf of the plan. In that case, it would be on an ongoing basis, and it could be fiduciary advice. Nobody's raised that argument. I'm just pointing out there are different ways to look at the situation. In that case, they would be a fiduciary if that argument succeeded. And it would raise a number of issues where they should be doing education rather than recommendations. But Brad, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so if the question is, can record keepers aggressively pursue rollovers from the plans that they're providing record keeping services to, then I would say yes, but I'd be careful. And the reason I say that is we are, as Fred said, we're back to the 1975 regulation because the DOL rule from 2016 was struck down by the courts. And DOL guidance from 2005, which was also struck down by that, which was killed by the 2016 regulation, we believe, absent any statements to the contrary from DOL, is resurrected. And that 2005 advisory opinion said that generally rollovers are not fiduciary advice, except in the circumstance where the rollover advisor is already a fiduciary to the plan. So assuming a record keeper is a non-fiduciary service provider and none of its affiliates are providing fiduciary advice, then, yeah, it would not be ERISA fiduciary advice to recommend rollovers. The reason I say be careful, though, is just because it's not ERISA fiduciary advice doesn't mean there aren't other standards that apply. And personally, I think you'd be best if you actually made a recommendation or solicited a rollover based on a consideration of all the relevant factors rather just than on whether you could get it. I'd like to see a documentation that shows you looked at the investments in the plan, you looked at the investments available in the IRA, the differences in fees for administrative and investments, the administrative services that are available in the plan versus the IRA. Do you have individual investment advice in the plan? Do you have good distribution options in the plan, monthly distribution without an additional fee? I'd feel a lot more comfortable for anyone recommending a rollover if they've looked at that and documented it. But that said, yes, the effect of the fiduciary rule's demise is that we're back to the pre-2016 rules on rollovers.
Yeah, and I would just say going forward, later this year we'll have regulation best interests in effect for broker-dealers, and the SEC interpretation for RIAs will be finalized. And both of those say that rollover recommendations are subject to the best interest standard, which is essentially a fiduciary standard, even though people don't call it that for broker-dealers. But in both cases, it appears that the SEC believes there are two recommendations, not just one. One recommendation is to liquidate the 401k account so that cash can be distributed. And you might ask yourself, how can you make a best interest recommendation if you don't even know what's in the account? That's a little mind-boggling. The second one is how to invest the rollover IRA. But anyway, think of it in terms of two recommendations, and I think it becomes somewhat clearer that what Brad is saying really makes sense. Operator, Kathy?
The first time for everything.
Hey, making sense, huh? Yeah, dollars
exactly.
And cents. So, Kathy, why don't we open it up to some questions on the phone lines?
Certainly. And ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your telephone keypad. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset or depress your mute function to allow that star one to reach our system. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open so that you may ask your question. Again, that is star one over the telephone keypads, and we'll pause for a moment to allow everyone the opportunity to signal. And again, that is star one for questions, and we'll go to our first caller. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, yes, this is Anna Ratner from CFP Board. I just have a follow-up question on the Nevada proposed regulation. Fred, you said that you believe there to be a private right of action. Are you reading that from Chapter 90 of the Nevada Code?
Hi, Anna, first and foremost. I don't have that in front of me, but I have looked at it, yes. I can't remember where it's located in there, but yeah. Brad, do you remember?
I'm afraid I'm in the same boat. I don't have that reference in front of me.
Okay, just wondering. Thank you.
Yeah, Anna, I'll dig that out and I'll email you. Let me see if I can find
Perfect.
It.
Perfect. Thanks so much.
Sure.
I would add in
Operator?
That even though Nevada has a private right of action, if it's with a broker-dealer, the fact that a particular state may not have a private right of action will not stop a claimant's counsel from bringing an arbitration, which asserts that as a violation. So
Kathy,
Currently, we had no other questions, but again, that is star one on your telephone keypad.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Fred, maybe one thing we can address, because I've been getting this question a lot from both advisors and plan sponsor clients is, hey, what's the deal with the IRS student loan issue? Can we go ahead and put in place a program, and where are we with that? The IRS issued a private letter ruling earlier this year, and it's since been revealed in the press. The Chicago Tribune reported that, and they confirmed that Abbott Laboratories was the recipient, that they had a program where if a worker elected to join that and they put 2% of their pay into student loan repayments, that then the plan sponsor would put 5% as an employer contribution into their 401k. And the IRS blessed that based on a couple of particular factors of how that was arranged. A lot of people are interested in copying something similar. A lot of the legislation in Congress has more liberal provisions than this private letter ruling provides. I think it's safe to say that if you want to do something anything other than the letter of the private letter ruling, you're going to be getting out in front of this a bit. And frankly, even if you copy the private letter ruling, while there may not be that much risk to it, technically it's only valid to the person to whom it was issued. There have been a lot of requests to IRS to come up with a more broad interpretation. They, of course, as Fred said, are closed right now. So stay tuned. I think it's fair to say there's a lot of understanding among folks in the government that this is an issue people want to do more on. They want to be able to link 401k contributions and student loan repayments. And I suspect we'll get better public policy answers coming up. But right now, all we have is that one private letter ruling, and it is narrow and technically not something you can rely on. Fred?
No, I agree, Brad. It is a private letter ruling. The word private means it's only for that taxpayer. So the only person with absolute protection is Abbott Laboratories. Others may feel that the private letter ruling provides them with an understanding of the IRS position on the issues and proceed, but you don't have that insurance policy. You're doing it based on analysis and logic, and that might be scary to some people. Well, I think we're at the witching hour. James, Kathy, thank you. James, let me turn it over to you to wrap it up.
Thanks, Fred. So, again, on behalf of Natixis and Drinker, Biddle, and Wreath, we just want to thank everybody for participating today and joining us for this call. The next session is scheduled for April 11th, 2019, so mark that down on your calendars, and I'm sure an invite will be sent out. Also, a replay of the recording will be available in the upcoming 3 business days. So, again, just to wrap up, we're very thankful for everyone that joined and wish everybody a great rest of the week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And again, ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's call. We thank you again for your participation. You may now disconnect.